KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the show, AIPAC versus the Squad. Alan Minsky will report on the Jamal Bowman primary coming up in New York State. And Katha Pollitt will talk about women voters after the Trump guilty verdict in the Stormy Daniels payoff trial. But first, today's political update with Harold Meyerson. Of course, he's editor-at-large of the American Prospect. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
Well, you've been looking into what we might call the psychology of Trump supporters, and you found research on something called precarious manhood. What is that?
Well, this was prompted by one of the weekly Tom Edsel columns in the New York Times, in which he looks at a range of issues, drawing on academic papers near and far. And he cited a far one over the last week, which really caught my attention. It was in a Journal of Social Psychology, and it looked at what it called measures of precarious manhood, which it determined by looking at the frequency of Google searches for terms like penis size, penis enlargement, Viagra, hair restoration, things like that. This was looking in the 12 months before the 2016 election. It found a very strong correlation between the frequency of those searches and voting for Donald Trump. Of course, in 2016, that was also voting against Hillary Clinton. So to be Freudian about it, this was overdetermined.
This was not sort of one-for-one correlations by individuals. This was based on district votes or state votes, isn't that right?
Yeah. Well, they had divided the United States into what I thought was about 120 regions. They showed a map. I don't quite know what determined where the boundary lines went, but it was the frequency of those terms within those regions.
And those are the regions that voted preponderantly for Trump.
Yeah, but even in regions that didn't vote preponderantly for Trump, where you also saw fewer of such searches. So it was a correlation by regional proclivity for those searches and regional proclivity for voting for Donald Trump. And they did it again for the congressional elections 2 years thereafter in 2018, found a similar correlation to voting for the Republican House candidates.
How do you explain the rise of precarious manhood as a political force? Are you a Freudian on this? You want to look at their childhood experiences?
No, I'm a Marxian on this. And I want to look at what has happened to working class men over this time period. You know, what has happened to working class men is that once upon a time, in sort of the world that Franklin Roosevelt made, for lack of a better term, World War II and the several decades after World War II, when the unions that were empowered by the New Deal employed, you know, had as members most of the American male workers who work with their hands, and they earned what was called then a family wage. They could support a family, even if their wives stayed at home. That began to fade several decades after the end of World War II. And they became, in many ways, less central to the American narrative, to the extent that we can even talk about such a thing as the American narrative. But, you know, then those jobs became less and less unionized, and there were, you know, you couldn't support a family on what you made doing blue collar work after, you know, the 1970s. And so this whole group was, you know, sort of felt somewhat disempowered, and they had trouble forming families. In fact, this was first noted in the Black community by the great sociologist William Julius Wilson, who coined the term marriageable male, and noted that many young Black women were meeting young Black men who they didn't think were marriageable because of their precarious economic situation. And in the decades since, William Julius Wilson coined that term, I think, in the early 1990s, the percentage of marriageable males among blue-collar men of all races in this country also fell precipitously, as did the rate of working-class marriages. So I think, you know, in terms of precarious males, there was at the root of a lot of this a sense of being economically precarious, and therefore, in terms of family relationships, precarious. And I think that, you know, explains a lot of what a lot of American politics has become. I mean, and you get this resentment against economic elites who are not blue collar, whose family relations and economic stability is not so precarious. And then you can get, not necessarily, but you can get a lashing out at other outgroups. You know, immigrants, people of color, the rise of women as such, and so on, which in 2016, a Republican presidential candidate came along who, you know, played that with the virtuosity of a Heifetz on the violin, if anyone remembers Heifetz on the violin, and that is Donald Trump.
Okay. So scientists have found that Trump voters are more likely to have searched Google for information about, and here was the list of search terms, erectile dysfunction, penis size, penis enlargement, hair loss, hair plugs, testosterone, and Viagra. They found a strong correlation for 2016 when he was running against Hillary. What about previous Republican candidates, John McCain and Mitt Romney? Did they find that their supporters were searching Google for penis enlargement?
Not at all. No, there was nothing about John McCain and Mitt Romney that resonated with these guys. If anything, Mitt Romney epitomized the economic establishment, and John McCain epitomized the traditional Republican political establishment. That was not really speaking to them. They needed someone speaking to them who, at some level, I think, shared that insecurity, which I think Donald Trump has always known that the real elites, particularly, you know, the business elites of New York, thought he was kind of a clown and looked down on him, and gave brilliant voice to the resentments and rages and stoked those resentments and rages so that what had been not there in 2008 and 2008 and 2012 was there in 2016, and I regret to say, ever since.
And there's some manifestations of that this year in organized union politics. The Teamsters, one of the biggest unions in America, has not endorsed Biden. And Teamster President Sean O'Brien, the news this week is that he asked for a speaking slot at the Republican National Convention, as well as the Democratic National Convention. Of course, earlier this year, the Teamsters gave $45,000 to both the Republican and the Democratic National Convention funds. I emailed you at the time this news came out, WTF.
Indeed, WTF. Well, I think Sean O'Brien is aware that there are probably more rank-and-file Teamsters, at least in the traditional truck driving and warehouse institutions that the Teamsters represent. They also represent a host of other occupations where this may not be the case. But among those occupations, it's probably the case that more of his members support Trump than support Biden. I would also point out that the kind of just almost free associative rage at portions of the establishment, or that he deems portions of the establishment, that Donald Trump indulges in his speeches, kind of has a sort of predecessor in the speeches of Jimmy Hoffa to his own members, who was again enraged against the corporate establishment and a bit of the white collar establishment as well. I mean, you know, in terms of a unionist, Hoffa, I think, was a brilliant success and really was committed to worker organization, whatever flaws he may have had. I know people who worked with him way back when, who, you know, said that any worker struggle he tried to get involved in, not to get members for the Teamsters, but just because he was on their side. There's that part of sort of the stereotypical image of the American truck driver, that he takes no crap from anyone and wants to, you know, back someone who audibly not only takes no crap, but gives a lot of crap to enemies real or imagined. So that's part of it. I would not be surprised if the Teamsters end up endorsing Biden. I think
let me just say the Teamsters did endorse Biden in 2020, although their support came relatively late in the election.
Yeah, I would think they'll do that again, but O'Brien will have covered his bases, as it were, with the rank and file. And look, what we know from the 2020 exit polls, if you break them down enough, this wasn't published, but if you break them down enough, union members who were college graduates supported Biden over Trump by a margin of nearly 50%. That's mainly teachers. And unions who were not college, union members who were not college graduates actually supported Trump by 6%. So I'm not sure the Teamsters are all that exceptional here.
Since there's some other news on the class struggle front about the United Auto Workers, on Monday they announced a tentative contract agreement at an Ohio factory making batteries for electric vehicles. The UAW called this a milestone in enhancing pay and safety in the EV supply chain. This contract covers 1,600 workers at a Lordstown plant operated as a joint venture between GM and a South Korean partner. They produce batteries for GM electric vehicles. These are workers who had not been unionized when the plant opened in 2022, but were brought into the UAW under the terms of that national contract the union negotiated with GM last fall. The UAW says this contract will serve as a template for the rest of their targets among battery plants. That seems like good news for all of us.
It is good news for all of us, and it's obviously good news for workers in EV plants that the union is able to organize. So, yeah, I mean, the auto workers have been very conscious of, you know, the coming of electric vehicles, and that it's quite possible that manufacturing electric vehicles will require fewer workers than manufacturing vehicles that rely on fossil fuels. But, you know, you can mitigate that to a certain degree if those EV workers are working under the same union contract as the fossil fuel workers. That you know, it creates a little shift in the balance of class forces in this country towards workers. Not enough, but it's a good start.
And I want to look at the bunch of new polls of the election, which have come out in the last week. Four new polls since the guilty verdict in the Trump trial. All of them show Biden gaining 2 or 3 points. Yahoo YouGov poll and the Morning Consult poll both now show Biden slightly ahead. And the most interesting thing to me in the polling news was that the website 538 unveiled a new forecasting model for 2024 this morning, that is Tuesday, and it gives Biden a 53% chance of winning the election. It shows Biden, the chance of Biden winning Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania is strong enough for them to predict he right now that he will carry those states. Chance of Biden win 59% in Michigan, 57% in Wisconsin, 57% in Pennsylvania, and that would give him 270 electoral votes, what he needs to win. And the other swing states, he's slightly behind. Arizona, chance of Biden win 48, Nevada 45, Georgia 43, North Carolina 40. But if he wins Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, he's elected president. Of course, that's a poll now, but it's one of the more scientific efforts to judge what's going to happen between now and November.
Yeah, obviously the verdict against Trump did help at the margins. I also tend to think that it's focusing more attention on Trump, which is ultimately Biden's strategy for winning, is if Americans pay sufficient attention to the real Donald Trump, Biden's chances rise. That almost more than anything is determinative of how this comes out.
And then there was another really interesting poll of Latino registered voters reported on Morning Joe, the largest poll of swing state Latinos. Biden ahead, but this was extremely significant. When third party candidates were included, Kennedy got 12%. 35% of Latino registered voters have a favorable opinion of Kennedy. That's compared to 34% for Trump, 44% favorable for Biden. So Kennedy seems to be a threat right now among Latino voters.
Well, the Kennedy campaign has been stressing his ties to his father. Actually, I mean, he was an infant when his father was murdered, but at least his gene pool. Of course, his father was really the first very major figure in American politics to highlight the cause of the farm workers unionizing under Cesar Chavez. I suspect that more than anything else is responsible for the elevated level of support for Kennedy Jr. I think the Biden campaign will work on that. I'm certain they will between now and November.
Yeah. One other really interesting finding in this poll, among 18 to 29-year-old Latino voters in Arizona and Nevada, 35% of them said they had signed up for government assistance in the last year. 22% said they had signed up for a second job. So really, the economy is hugely important to young Latino voters.
Yeah, it is. And in Nevada in particular, the economy has never really recovered from the pandemic. Just fewer people have been coming to Vegas. And that creates a big hole in the Nevada economy. And young people are the most vulnerable simply by virtue of age of falling into that hole.
We have a few minutes left for a quick analysis of last weekend's European Parliament elections. We were alarmed over the weekend when the first news we got on Sunday was that there had been a decisive turn to the far right across Europe. That turned out to be wrong.
It did turn out to be wrong. And you know, any number of countries like Poland and Scandinavia, this proved to be not true at all. But in the two major countries in the European Union, it was true in Germany and France. And that's sobering. And of course, in France, President Macron made a bizarre decision to roll the dice just after the far-right party, which is sort of the great grandchild of the fascists of the Vichy regime, came in with almost a third of the vote, almost doubling the vote of any other party. You know, we're now facing a really fascinating situation in which the old French right, historically anti-Semitic, now anti-immigrant and a little anti-Semitic to supplement that, is forming as a bloc. The leader of the Gaullist Party today being Tuesday, was saying he wants to form a bloc with Le Pen's right-wing party. And all the parties of the left, though, harking back to the 1930s, have formed their own bloc with the socialists, the communists, the Greens, and French insoumise all coming together. And it has taken, as was the case in the 30s, it has taken the rise of a native fascist movement, a neo-fascist, to create a neo-popular front. It's also quite possible that with those two forces at play, Macron's own party will come in, you know, really dribbling in with fairly meager results in the parliamentary elections yet to be held later this month.
And finally, a few words about the Reverend James Lawson, a giant of the civil rights movement here in Los Angeles for the last many decades, who died on Sunday.
Jim Lawson, whom I knew, was an amazing figure who, along with Bayard Rustin, really provided the instruction to the fledgling civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s on how to do nonviolent militant protests, the freedom rides, the sit-ins at lunch counters, and so on, which really put the movement on the front pages and changed law and behavior in much of the United States, in all of the United States in terms of law. And then Jim Lawson came out to Los Angeles many decades ago and was omnipresent in all kinds of worker struggles and civil rights struggles, certainly not just for the Black community, for every embattled minority. He was really this very important figure for Los Angeles progressives over the last almost 50 years. He lived to a ripe old age of 95. And LA and the rest of the country will miss him very much.
Harold Meyerson, read him at prospect.org. Thank you, Harold. Always great to have you on the show.
Always great to be here, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. AIPAC, the Israel lobby, is spending millions of dollars to defeat Representative Jamal Bowman of New York. He's a leading progressive and member of the Squad. This will be in the New York State Democratic primary on June 25th. For comment, we turn to Alan Minsky. He is executive director of Progressive Democrats of America. That's a grassroots group working to advance progressive policies and help elect progressive candidates. He's also one of the producers of this show. Alan, welcome back.
Great to be here, John. Thank you.
Well, first, tell us about Jamal Bowman.
Well, Jamal Bowman is, by the way, the one male member of what is deemed the Squad, of which there are now 8 members. And he is one of 2 members who are considered especially vulnerable in this election cycle. The Squad, since it emerged on the scene in 2018, has added members each of the next successive cycles. Jamal Bowman, again, upsetting longstanding Congressman Elliot Engel in a primary 2 cycles ago, and then getting reelected comfortably last cycle. And it's a heavily Democratic district, so whoever wins the primary will be very much expected to win the general in November. And Jamal Bowman, like the other Squad members, is pretty much defines and represents the left wing of the Democratic Party, supporting, broadly speaking, progressive domestic policies, and also speaking out for shifts in U.S. foreign policy.
And let's talk about his district. It's just north of Manhattan, some of the Bronx, and then Westchester County. It's wildly diverse. It's described by the New York Times as home to one of the best organized Jewish communities in the country, and also with a non-white majority who sees him as a paragon of progressive Black leadership. It's 40% white, 30% Latino, 20% Black, 7% Asian. This is America.
Look, I also want to point this out about Jamal Bowman. Right now, one of the, of course, steady themes in the press is the way in which the working class is gravitating towards the Republican Party, away from the Democratic Party, including particularly working class men of color have somewhat, at least in the period between elections, seems to be drifting that way. I would argue this is because the Republican Party gives voice to the anger people feel about how difficult the economy is to navigate, the mainstream of the Democratic Party much less so. I would also argue the Republican Party, in expressions of anger, have no policy solutions for this. You have to look at the left wing of the Democratic Party, where you see similar expressions of discontent, but with sound policy solutions. And as for working class men of color, as I said, the one male member of the Squad, Jamal Bowman, stands out as somebody who can really connect with people across the country with expressions of discontent, but with him combined with exceptional policies for solutions.
And tell us about his opponent in the Democratic primary, George Latimer.
Well, my main take on Latimer in this race is, of course, that he is a cipher to receive an incredible amount of outside and dark money support, motivated largely due to issues around Israel and Palestine, but also, as we saw in 2021 and 2022, when Israel and Palestine were not so much as much a hot button issue as, of course, they are today, these channels have also been ways in which very right-wing money and then conservative Democratic money can pour in against progressives and try to defeat progressives. So he's a cipher for that. He's a willing cipher for that money. He's a career, almost bureaucratic style politician who was in the New York Senate for a couple terms out of Westchester, out of the more prosperous part of this district, not from down in the Bronx. And he also has served as a county elected official across Westchester, very much a sort of a New York party machine politician.
So it was after the October 7th attack that Jamal Bowman emerged as what the New York Times called one of Israel's most forceful critics in Congress. He condemned Hamas's actions on October 7th as abhorrent, but he also called for a permanent ceasefire back in October, more than 7 months ago. And he's been consistent in calling what's happening in Gaza right now, quote, an ongoing genocide, close quote. And of course, he's called for the United States to cut off all offensive military aid to Israel. That's why AIPAC is targeting him. Remind us about AIPAC and where their money comes from and where it's going.
AIPAC is, of course, the dominant institution as a lobbying force inside the American political system for unequivocal, no questions asked support for Israel. And that has included a support for the Netanyahu government and in the era in which Israeli politics have drifted consistently to the right. They would bundle money through their supporters, and the money would then be sent into campaigns through that process. But they actually were not directly involved in creating a super PAC to throw money into races directly until the 2022 cycle. But boy, did they jump in then. And the money comes from, I would argue, as much from Republicans and far-right Republicans as it does from Democrats. And their main target has been Democratic progressives in Democratic primaries. And in this particular race, I would argue, because of that dynamic, and this by all measures seems to be the race in which the largest amount of money is going to come from AIPAC and AIPAC affiliated channels to oppose Jamal Bowman, that actually what we have on our hands in New York's 16th congressional district is the closest election we have seen anywhere in the world to a referendum on what is transpiring right now in Israel, Gaza, and Palestine.
Jamal Bowman, I see, has been endorsed by the Sierra Club, Planned Parenthood, most of the big unions, and by the Working Families Party, by DSA, by Jewish Voices for Peace, by Progressive Democrats of America, and of course by AOC, whose district is right next to his, and by the House Democratic leadership, I guess mostly because he's an incumbent. So there's a lot more to Jamal Bowman's politics than his positions on America's support for Israel's war in Gaza. Naomi Klein wrote about him for the New York Daily News this week. She started not with Gaza, but with his support for the Green New Deal and for the New York State follow-up program, which I learned is called the Build Public Renewables Act. Only after that did she go into his demand for a ceasefire in Gaza, which she pointed out is now supported by the majority of Americans, the majority of Democrats, and the majority of American Jews. She said 69% of Democratic voters in Bowman's district support a ceasefire too. So he's broadly speaking a leader of progressive politics and not just on Israel.
Right. But here's the big problem. He is going up against what is estimated to be certainly over $10 million dropped into his district, and many people estimate could go as high as $20 or $25 million. If it gets that high, it becomes the most expensive house race in the history of American elections. And this, we should remind people, is a primary. Okay.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Here's the thing. I mean, we all, John, think that if we were dropped into Orwell's 1984, or into Nazi Germany or Stalin's Russia, that we ourselves would have the will to not give in to the propaganda. We would see through it. We would overcome it. What the people in New York 16th District are being besieged by now is an avalanche through the media and through some other channels, right? Things will be on your doorstep and such in your mail of propaganda that is absolutely state-of-the-art propaganda. Look, that people who are spending the money at AIPAC Sadly, they have a pretty good record when it comes to winning elections. They've lost some high-profile ones recently, Summer Lee, yay, but they mainly win. And they win because when they spend that money, they spend it on the best people they can hire. This is state-of-the-art 21st century propaganda, 75 years on from Goebbels and Stalin, et cetera, right? This stuff is refined. This is it's market-tested. And you're going to have to overcome an avalanche of why Jamal Bowman bad, George Saddam Vladimir is just exactly the public servant we all want and have always wanted to represent us in Washington, D.C. And that's going to be absolutely flooding your brain over the next few weeks if you're in New York 16. So we have to make as strong a case as possible to every voter there as to why it is not a good idea to vote for George Latimer and, yes, to vote for Jamal Bowman.
One more thing. Jamal Bowman, while he criticizes Joe Biden's support for Israel, he does support Biden for president. His campaign website says he voted for Biden's proposals 94% of the time. So that suggests the way that he can be a key link to young people who are not enthusiastic about Biden and not planning to vote for him.
Jamal Bowman's very, very eloquent and very capable of reaching people, sometimes who otherwise may not be able to be reached because he is a very distinctive figure in American politics. He's very personable, very human, and a former principal of a school, right? He can reach people. And so it shouldn't be lost on people that a defeat by Jamal Bowman will be very damaging, I believe, for the capacity of the Democratic Party to draw in people who will see his defeat as symbolic of their exclusion from the Democratic Party coalition. So I think it's important in that regard. If you want to defeat Donald Trump in November, you're going to want to see Jamal Bowman be victorious in this election on the 25th.
And I want to just talk for a couple of minutes about the rest of the squad in the primaries. You mentioned that first was Summer Lee in Pittsburgh. We thought AIPAC was going to go in against her with big money, but in the end they decided not to, and she won, arguing to mainstream Democrats that she could help turn out young voters and voters of color who are not enthusiastic about voting for Biden. Jamal Bowman is next, June 25th. After that, we have Cori Bush in St. Louis on August 6th. And AIPAC has already announced they will be going after her.
Well, great. And I do want to say with this also about Jamal Bowman. It isn't just, again, those swing voters and in working class communities of color. There's a question as to whether progressives and young progressives in particular are swing voters in these elections. All of the members of the squad are the most popular young politicians in the country among young progressives. To see them lose to what effectively is an operation that, yes, you listed all the people that the Democratic Party establishment has supporting Bowman, but there's a tacit allowing of this kind of money pouring into the Democratic Party and to young progressives who are very critical of the whole political system. Seeing that money defeat someone like Bowman in a primary, I believe that will be very difficult to win them back into the Democratic Party coalition if Jamal Bowman or Cori Bush are defeated.
Well, finally, it's time for your Minnesota moment. That's news from my hometown of St. Paul that you won't get from Sean Hannity. August 13th is the Minnesota primary, and the most important contest there is the challenge to Ilhan Omar. It's coming from the same guy who came pretty close to defeating her last time. He's Don Samuels. He's a Jamaican immigrant, a 75-year-old former Minneapolis City Council member. He came within 2 points of defeating her in 2022, again, with a lot of AIPAC support. Last time, his big issue was crime. This was in the wake of the George Floyd protests. She had endorsed abolishing the Minneapolis police. He was against that. This year, that's not going to work anymore. And so he has made Gaza his initially most important issue. He criticized the Minneapolis City Council when it passed a resolution back in January calling for a permanent ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. Ilhan Omar, of course, is one of the first members of Congress to adopt that position. But it's an interesting sign of the times that Ilhan Omar's opponent now calls for a ceasefire. He said, quote, "Over time, the conflict of Israel and Palestine has become so frightening that everybody agrees it is too extreme, and I do too. We need a ceasefire." Omar told the Min Post that AIPAC, quote, "has always played in my primary races, and it's not going to be different this year," close quote. It's not clear yet how active AIPAC will be in that race. What's your sense of Ilhan Omar right now?
Well, I actually think Ilhan Omar's race and Cori Bush's race, the table will be set by the result in Jamal Bowman's race. If Jamal Bowman can defeat George Latimer in this race, I think it would be a game changer in a number of ways. First of all, it doesn't speak to the general issue of defeating big money in politics, though that would be a huge victory there because nothing will have changed in terms of those relations. However, it will represent a singular defeat for AIPAC more than any other opportunity we have right now. And here is where this has real geopolitical significance. Everybody in the world understands that the United States of America is the country that Israel relies upon for its continuing operations, not only militarily, but also generally, even though there's been a little bit of a warble in this over the past few weeks, which has been a good thing from the Biden administration standing in opposition to the Netanyahu position per a ceasefire, including at a UN vote recently. And the United States is the country that Israel relies upon. The most powerful institutional force that locks in place U.S. policy towards Israel is AIPAC. This is an opportunity to defeat AIPAC. If Jamal Bowman can defeat George Latimer, have no illusions, this will create more room for Joe Biden to separate himself out from Netanyahu internationally, which, by the way, I believe is essential for Joe Biden's reelection chances. Okay, one more thing to say, too, and I do want to end with this. I think everybody who is in the New York 16th has to reflect on this issue. If you are considering voting in a way that is influenced by what's going on in Israel and Gaza, and I believe you probably are, it's a huge issue in this election. Let me ask you this. If you're somebody who considers the welfare of Israel in terms of the whole conflagration in the Middle East, not exactly my position. I try my best to prioritize the welfare of the Palestinians and all the people in the district equally, support self-determination for all the people. But if that is the way that you approach it, and I know there must be many of the voters in the district are, why on earth at this hour would you vote for an AIPAC-backed candidate? AIPAC has locked in place support for a set of policies that have proved to be the most devastating for the Israel and the entire history of the state of Israel. Again, I'm just echoing someone like Tom Friedman here, who says that Netanyahu's not only been the worst prime minister in the history of Israel, he's been the worst leader in the history of the Jews, right?
Yes.
If you do support the welfare of the state of Israel, which I know many voters in the district are, I would say a vote for George Latimer is a vote against the best interests of Israel.
Alan Minsky, he's Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America. Alan, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. The Trump convictions, guilty of 43 felonies in the Stormy Daniels payoff case, are all about the politics of gender. For comment, we turn to Katha Pollitt. Of course, she's a poet, essayist, and award-winning columnist for The Nation. Her writing also appears in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and The New York Times. We reached her today at home in Manhattan. Hi, Katha.
Hi. Hi, John.
Well, let's recall what this was about. Right after the Access Hollywood tape came out in 2016, according to the testimony of Michael Cohen, Trump said, "Guys may think it's cool, but this is going to be a disaster for the campaign. Women will hate me," close quote. And it was at that point that they got the news that Stormy Daniels was about to tell her story of sex with Trump. So he paid for her silence. He won the election narrowly. Trump, throughout this trial, insisted he never had sex with Stormy Daniels, and he never paid for her silence. She had some pretty convincing testimony that they did have sex. So who sides with Trump here, and who believes the woman? Let's start with Trump's family. Throughout the trial, Don Jr. and Eric publicly defended their father, but Melania and Ivanka never appeared at his side during the trial, never said a word in his defense, The evidence, of course, was that Trump had sex with Stormy Daniels about a month after Melania gave birth to their son, Barron. Ivanka had a single post on Instagram after the guilty verdicts. You've seen it. Fox News described it as a heartfelt message to her father. "I love you, Dad," the message read, along with a heart emoji and a picture of young Ivanka with her father. Is anything missing from Ivanka's post about the Trump Stormy Daniels payoff verdict?
"I believe you, Dad. You were railroaded, Dad. The whole thing was rigged, Dad."
Yeah, she didn't say any of those things. And the silence speaks volumes, they say. So there's a huge gender gap in Trump's immediate family over the charges of paying off Stormy Daniels. On a broader stage, there is growing evidence that even before the trial, the gender gap in American politics had become, in the words of Thomas Edsall, a gender gulf. Much of this is from Tom Edsall's New York Times column. Young men have repeatedly been found in recent years to be apathetic toward voting, while young women in recent election cycles are constantly turning out to vote at higher rates than young men. Do you have an explanation for this phenomenon?
Well, again, to plagiarize from Tom Edsall, young women have a lot of reasons to vote. Dobbs, Supreme Court ruling striking down Roe v. Wade, mobilized a lot of people. There was Me Too going back a few years, and there's Donald Trump himself, who every day demonstrates his contempt for women and his fake pseudo-hypermasculinity. Women see that, talking about rigged, the system is rigged against them and they're at great risk, and that motivates them to vote.
And of course, there are more women than men in this country. They make up a larger proportion of the electorate. They're more motivated to vote and more likely to vote Democratic. And according to these polls, it's not just abortion. For young women, two other issues are also salient: climate change and guns. And young men express far less interest in climate change and guns. Why would that be?
Well, I wonder that too. I guess the reason they wouldn't be so against guns is they've all got them.
Okay. And they're going to protect their women with these guns.
Oh, yeah, right. If they don't shoot their women, they're going to protect them. As for climate change, I don't know, because that's something that falls on everybody. But I think that probably young men are a little more disbelieving about climate change because of they're more likely to be right wing and to imbibe all that propaganda that it's all not happening.
I looked up the statistics on the gender gap in 2020, sort of the starting point for where we are today. Biden plus 15, that means the gap between women and men in their percent vote for Biden is 15 points. For young women, that is women under 30, the gap is 35 points. Pretty incredible. However, white women voted for Trump plus 8 points, and evangelical women, we know, of course, they're Trump's base, but the figure here is even more astounding, plus 43. Your comment?
Well, I think if you look at the white women figure, that's because of the evangelical vote. I think if you took out the evangelicals, you would find that white women, like other women, are Democrats. So it's really Jesus's fault, you know. Really, what is he doing? What does he think he's doing here?
If only we could get him on the podcast or one of his spokespeople.
That would be great. But you know, one thing that was very interesting in the stuff that I was reading around this subject is that, get this, young men, says this person called Lampert, are not necessarily conservative in a traditional sense. And in the United States, young men are still more freedom-oriented than older men, whatever freedom-oriented is, but are more geared toward ambition, bravery, honor, innovation, loyalty, success, wealth, and luxury. So in other words, men are more obsessed with power and money, and women are more obsessed with having control over their bodies and freedom to be who they want to be. Those are very different orientations.
And the other big difference, according to the polls, is that, this is a quote, nearly half of young men believe that American society has become, quote, too soft and feminine, close quote. And of course, these are the people who Trump is appealing to. And it's true, the Democrats want to help you get medicine, help you get to the doctor. And Trump is more interested in other things.
Yeah, there's a top Trump ally, Charlie Kirk, and he says, I love this quote, birth control, quote, screws up female brains, unquote, and makes women bitter, angry, and unattractive to men, and it turns them into Democrats.
Worst of all.
Really? So it's all the fault of birth control. I mean, honestly, you know, it's like they're reaching for just any crazy old thing to say, but the threat to birth control is quite real. And this is part of the whole package of why women should not have reproductive control.
Yeah. And let me underline here, this is about birth control, not about abortion rights. On the question of the gender gap and Trump, I couldn't help noticing the article in the New York Times about Trump's first public appearance after his guilty verdict. It was Saturday night in Newark at the UFC Ultimate Fighting Championship fight, where a virtually all-male crowd came to see what the New York Times described as a brutal three-hour cage fight, a violent spectacle, blood-spattered, brutish, and brawny, where a fighter from California named Kevin Holland and a fighter from Poland named Mikhail Olejewski beat each other to a pulp inches from Mr. Trump's face. The former president watched with interest as the American got the pole on the ground, secured his right arm, and appeared to yank it out of its socket. The victorious American then emerged from the ring, walked over to Mr. Trump, bent down and shook hands, leaning in to hear the former president tell him something, and clapped his left hand on Mr. Trump's shoulder. That moment was projected onto the colossal video screens high above the ring. The crowd roared, Klieg lights swiveled onto Trump and his entourage, and the sound system amped up the bass that was thumping now with the White Stripes revenge song, I'm gonna fight him off, a Seven Nation Army couldn't hold me back. Trump stood up, stood around to face the crowd, pumping his fist, and the arena answered back, USA, USA, USA. Do you have any comment, Katha?
Well, you just wonder how men and women are ever going to get married, you know? Who would want to be married to these men? What is it? The world must be peopled, as in some famous play. I'm forgetting the quote.
The world must be peopled. That's from Much Ado About Nothing. I looked it up.
The world must be peopled, and people have to get together somehow. Not everybody can be gay, lesbian, or something else. And you just wonder, how is it going to happen? I mean, there were just a few women in the thing, and they were for Trump too, mentioned in the article, they were for Trump too. And the thing that was amazing to me is the imperviousness of the Trumpies to anything bad about him. And I suppose we'll get a chance to see if the same thing is true of Democrats at the Hunter Biden trial. But the difference being Hunter isn't running for president.
Yes. So it seems to us that the effect of the guilty verdicts will be that more women will vote for Biden, or at least fewer women will vote for Trump. Do you think we're going out on a limb here?
I think that is likely to happen. So then it's going to be a question of turnout, because when people are feeling depressed and anxious and like, he's so old and, you know, what has he ever done for me? Then they might just stay home. And here I want to say, Biden has done a lot. People don't know this. They don't know about the insulin, affordable insulin. They don't know about changes in healthcare that benefit people. They don't know how hard he's tried to get student loans canceled. The Supreme Court wouldn't let him do that, but still he does what he can in other ways. And, you know, and here he is arguably trying to corner Netanyahu into some kind of a ceasefire. And I just think, what do people want? What would count as, oh, he did something for me?
And on the other side of the gender gap, the question is whether this trial verdict will increase his turnout among the young, especially white working class men who go to the UFC championship fight.
Well, one of the words that was in the Tom Edsel article about to describe young men was apathetic. So I'm always surprised around election when people say, oh, yeah, I meant to vote. I just forgot. Or I would have voted if I'd known he was on the ticket. I mean, people just say the wildest things. I mean, I'm not an expert of any kind. I'm trying to think of things I'm an expert in and failing. Sorry.
Poetry, that's something.
Poetry. I'm extremely anxious. And the prospect of being this anxious all the way until November makes me depressed.
Katha, I think many of our listeners are with you in your concluding remarks. Katha Pollitt's column appears in Nation magazine. You can read it at thenation.com. Katha, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me, John. It's always a pleasure.
That's it for today's Living in the USA. Our social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Thanks as always to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you miss part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at livinginthusapod.com. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.